That leads us to the second case, 20-2066, Sanofi Adventis versus Mylan Pharmaceuticals. Mr. Banks.
May I proceed, Your Honors? Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Banks for the appellant, Sanofi. There are three sets of issues in this group of appeals. I will focus my time today on the written description issue as it relates to the 844 patent. I'll also address the proposed substitute claims to the 486 patent, and the Steenfeld-Jensen issue that we were all just discussing is also present in these appeals. My colleague, Mr. Ainslie, addressed those already this morning. Happy to address any additional questions the court has about.
I've got one, and sure. That is the relationship between the 844 piece of this IPR and the district court decision. If we were to affirm the district court's determination of lack of written description, does that decide the 844 piece of this IPR?
If you were to affirm it, I think it might. The issues are different and the records are different, so it depends on the reasons.
I'm sorry, it would be the same claims with one exception, namely the substitute claim, but you've argued the substitute claim is identical. In this one, you make no separate argument for 31 surviving if 21 doesn't.
Well, I think
the district court decision, if sure. we were to affirm on written description, would end up cancellation of 21 through 30.
The way I would approach this analysis is that, particularly as it relates to the amended claim, obviously, the district court decision doesn't relate to that at all. We have argued them sort of together, but I think the error here with respect to the amended claim is plainer with respect to the 844 decision and in the group two appeals that we're talking about here. I think if you look at the language of the claim and the language of the application, the disclosure, they are identical, right? So you've got a disclosure of a threaded piston rod and a claim to a threaded piston rod. And the error that the board made here with respect to finding that it lacked written description support is much clearer to see with the lens of looking at the amended claim, because what the board essentially did was read threaded in the disclosure to mean only externally threaded. And the reason it did that is because of the way that the figure is depicted in the application. And there's no unambiguous limitation in the specification or elsewhere that would limit the disclosure just to that embodiment. And so therefore, the error of doing so is clear on the record here, especially when viewed in the lens of the amended claim. Now, we have argued that they have the same scope.
Help me here. As I understand it, if we were to agree with the district court's written description decision, that would knock out all of the existing claims. There's an overlap between the ones in the IPR and the district court. Correct? That would necessarily have that result, right?
The claims, right, that's correct, but the amended claim obviously was not asserted.
Why is the amended claim, which is not involved in the district court case, patentably distinct? Why is it different in terms of written description?
It's different for the reason that I was just mentioning, but the claim language is identical to the description in the patent, right? So what the burden that Mylan would have to show to demonstrate a lack of written description support is that much greater with respect to the amended claim, given the identity of the language between the description and what is claimed. So I may start going into the argument about
too late to start.
but focusing on the board's decision here, again, the application discloses a threaded engagement between a piston rod.
What is the language of the substitute claim?
The substitute claim is a piston rod comprising a thread.
Where do we find that?
That is, bear with me, Your Honor. If you look at
210, I think it's set out.
I'm sorry.
It's at Appendix 210, is
210,
that right?
210, that's right. That's it. Yeah. Well, 218 as
Wait,
well.
Which page?
218, I see it.
218?
Yeah. It's a driving member comprising a third thread and a piston rod comprising a fourth thread.
The full claim is at 210. It shows old claim 21, and the only thing 31 does is remove six words, right? Either an internal or an external, and then substitute the word A for a fourth thread.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think the way, one way to think about this, right, is a thought experiment that's a real experiment in terms of what the language of the claim says, right? And the language of the claim says...
Okay, but does substitute claim 31 include both an internal and an external thread?
The scope of it does include both an internal and external thread. That's right, Your Honor. But I think it illustrates, looking at it this way,
So what you did is you took a claim that referred expressly to both and just generalized it so that it covers both but no longer expressly enumerates the two options.
That's correct. But I think looking at this again helps crystallize the error that the board made here, right? There are only two ways to configure a threaded connection between a driver and a piston rod. Either the driver has external threads that engage internal threads on the piston rod, or vice versa. They are interchangeable. They are necessarily complements of each other. One requires the other one. You have to have internal threads on one component engage with external threads on another component. And both of these ways were known in the art. There's prior art of medical injection devices comprising internally threaded piston rods that was before the board. And so putting these pieces together, the question really is, was there anything in the specification or the application that would limit the broad disclosure of the threaded engagement to only one of the two ways? And there's nothing in the specification that does that. There's nothing that limits unambiguously the broad disclosure to only the illustrated embodiment. And that's the core error that the board...
I don't understand why that's an error. I mean, if it covers both, both have to have written description support.
Correct, and I think that's correct. But the description of threaded necessarily includes both. Like as I was mentioning, you know, the nature of a threaded connection. You can see this based on the party's own definition of thread, is that one set of components engages with another set of components, and it doesn't matter which has what as internal threads and which has external threads. They both operate in the same way, and that was the teaching that was known in the art at the time of the invention. And I think beyond this...
Okay, can I ask, I think it's in the district court case, okay. Or maybe it's here, your expert testified and said, oh, let me show you how to do this. And roughly speaking, I think, it got very complicated. Is that only in the district court case, or does that evidence appear in this IPR also?
Yeah, they overlap to a certain extent, Your Honor, because it began with a picture that our expert drew on the spot at his deposition in this IPR.
Oh, in here.
How the device would be configured with an internally threaded piston rod.
But why does that not offer, you know, meaningful evidentiary support for what, after all, is a factual finding about because we said written description is a factual finding, for the idea that if the question is, does the written description support describe the entire device with the internals, that evidence suggests actually it really doesn't, because if you change the external to the internal, you got to do a bunch of other things, rearrange other components, maybe add this stinger piece. Isn't that substantial evidence support for the idea that the fact that they are kind of mirror images in some way or other, just focusing on the thread groove piece, does not mean you've described devices with the alternative?
Sure. I think there's two responses to that. I think the underlying sort of legal point that we would say is that the ultimate question is, given the broad nature of the affirmative disclosure of a threaded piston rod, the question really is, does the description preclude both types of questions? And I think that was the reason why this whole line of inquiry went down.
Why is that the right question?
Because I think if you look at the word threaded and the definition of threaded that the parties had offered, and the fact that there are only two ways to engage such a connection, and that you have to imagine both necessarily. You have to necessarily imagine one threaded element connecting to another one, and without regard to which one has the threads. The pertinent question, and the reason that this became an issue...
And when you say you just read the word threaded, You mean in the claim, or do you mean in early sentence in at the first page of the Great Britain application, presumably in the spec here too, that also doesn't put the qualifiers in? Are you referring to which one are you saying matters?
Correct. I'm referring to the description in the application, and the reason this became an issue, and the reason why the testimony that you're referring to with respect to the district court record was an issue, was that the reason Mylan argued that it could only work one way is because that it would buckle. It wouldn't work if it was done the different way. And the whole point of what Dr. Slocum did was to rebut the unsubstantiated view that it wouldn't work the way that he described. And so the credibility finding, and the district court's finding in this respect, and the board's as well, was backwards in the sense that where we had evidence on the one hand without support or whatsoever that the device would not work as configured as Dr. Slocum drew it. And then Dr. Slocum's affirmative testimony that it would, which the district court specifically credited, demonstrating that it would work. I think the credibility read that they came to is the opposite that one would come to, which is you've got no testimony whatsoever that, no evidence whatsoever that it wouldn't work, and only the evidence that it would, that was credited. And so that underscores the point to bring it back to the beginning, which is given the breadth of the disclosure, that is the threaded connection, and the fact that we've shown that it works in both ways.
I just want to be absolutely clear. So tell me if I'm wrong about this. My understanding or recollection of the spec is there's that one statement early on that refers to the threading without saying internal or external. Otherwise, there is nothing in the spec that is similarly generic. So you're hanging your hat on that one kind of introductory statement as being generic and therefore having to be limited by something?
It is in the introduction. It's on the first pages of the first two pages of the application inside appendix 3934 and 3935. But it's the core description in the summary of the invention of the drive engagement, right? Which is the part that describes the threaded engagement between the piston rod and the driver. And so that's where one would look for.
You would acknowledge that everything else in the spec is limited to the internal thread, internal or external.
The picture demonstrates or describes or draws an externally threaded rod, but there nowhere else in the spec does it describe the threading one way or the other, right? So the point of why this is important is that you've got a general description here of the way the threaded engagement works that doesn't specify or limit it to only one of the two.
Could we make anything of the fact that what the engagement is with is a sleeve?
I think that it's obviously part of what the claim
doesn't,
talks about.
Doesn't that rather suggest that the threads are on the outside of the piston rod that's inside the sleeve? You don't talk about a sleeve as inserted into the thing that it is a sleeve around.
I think it can work that way, which is why it's illustrated that way. But it can also work the other way, which is the way that Dr. Slocum described it. And if you look
That wouldn't be much of a sleeve.
Well, I think it's useful to actually look at the drawing that he drew because you can see that the sleeve has a component, the stinger part that he called it, that is in the very center of the pen, but is connected to the rest of the sleeve, which surrounds the piston rod. So it's still a sleeve. It only has a driver, the stinger, as he called it, in the middle. And you can think about a thing like a deodorant dispenser, right, which has the spindle in the middle, right, but connected to the broader container, which you might imagine as a sleeve. And the point that Dr. Slocum made is that you can take the sleeve and just simply add the stinger in the middle, and you've got the device that's described in the specification. And importantly, he demonstrated that it would work. And that's important because, again, the main claim that Mylan made was the only way you can envision and construct a device in the spec is with the externally threaded piston rod. And he disproved that, right? And that's important in considering, again, the way the court and the board here came to understand the evidence.
You're almost out of time. I'll give you a minute to talk about the 486.
Sure. So the 486 The board here erred in denying the contingent motions to amend with respect to the 486 patent. I think the common theme across each of these errors is that the board did not attend to the specific claim language or the specific disclosures in the prior art. Emblematic of this, I think, is claim 58, which relates to an arc-shaped body that's configured to track each dose of medicament delivered. There are no prior art examples of a device having only one arc-shaped body. To the extent there are things like half nuts and so forth in the arc, they are two halves joined together to function together as a whole.
With respect to these structural limitations, is it not the case that you didn't make this argument before the board?
I do believe we made these arguments before the board, Your Honor. So
can you show me where?
In my rebuttal time, I can certainly find J, but I don't think that was an argument that was raised in the red brief.
I mean, they said in the petition that these other limitations were satisfied. The board, according to you, didn't address them other than to summarize the record evidence, the arguments that they presented. But if you didn't argue that those limitations were not satisfied, I'm not sure why the board has to address it.
The board did address these limitations, Your Honor. So the board did address them, and we think got them quite wrong. If you would look at, let me get the record site for you. If you look at the appendix, I want to say 90. The part I'm talking about, actually 65 to 67 is the piece I'm discussing right now. The board has an extensive discussion about the one arc-shaped body limitation. And the board's conclusion is that there was sufficient art in the record to show that there were things like half nuts and split nuts and so forth in the art. But the error the board made was that all of these are examples of half nuts joined together to function as a full nut, and the claim is to just one. And that appears nowhere in the art. And what the board did was fill that gap in the art with no analysis really whatsoever, just saying that because these were known, it would work, right? That because it would ease assembly. That's not a teaching that was in the prior art anywhere. In fact, the teaching that using a half nut to aid assembly is something that's found in the 486 patent itself. So that's certainly improper hindsight to have relied on that.
What do you do with the board's finding that using the half nut would in fact have the advantage, a recognized advantage of aiding in the assembling of the thing?
So my answer there is that that teaching, that suggestion that it would aid assembly is something that's found in the 486 patent itself. It's not something that was in the prior art. I think the board relies solely on the Moeller reference to provide that gap. But Moeller doesn't talk about half nuts whatsoever. It talks about other types of components joined together again to function as a full component. And here the point is that this is one arc shaped body to function as a half nut or as a half circle itself. And that's new, and that wasn't in the prior art. I see I've well into my rebuttal time. Unless the court has further questions, I'm happy to rest on the brief.
Okay, but what I'm looking for in your rebuttal is whether you argued that the prior art was missing the flexible clicker arms and the positioning of the second clicker near the distal end.
Okay, I will adjust that in a moment.
Okay, all right, thank you. All right, Mr. Carlson.
You can breathe again. Good morning. And may it please the court. This is a plain application of Ariad. Ariad presents written description as a question of fact, and the board properly considered the Great Britain application, and it considered it for what it actually discloses to a person of ordinary skill in the art. And there are significant factual findings that Sanofi can't really overcome by pointing to the single word threaded. The question that Ariad poses is, does the disclosure taken as a whole teach the person or show the person of ordinary skill in the art as of the filing date that the inventors possessed the invention, i.e. possessed the claim invention, invented the claim invention. The claimed invention, as we just heard from Mr. Banks, is internal and externally threaded piston rods. But that's not the claimed invention. The claimed invention contains that. But there's factual findings about the complexity of what the claimed invention is. For example, at APPX 138 through 9, the panel below credits Carl Leinsing's testimony about how this is a concentrically designed injection pen where the piston rod is the innermost member. This is exactly the point that Judge Toronto was asking about earlier. If it's a sleeve around a rod, then it's obviously externally threaded. So it's not as straightforward or as simple as Sanofi would have you believe that there are simply two choices here. To pick up a question that the panel had for...
Can you remind me, did the board make anything of this sleeve idea that I injected?
I believe they did, and I just pointed you to, Your Honor, to APPX 138 and 9. And I think that is really sort of underscores the panel's skepticism about Dr. Slocum and Dr. Slocum's so-called stinger idea, which was thoroughly discredited at pages APPX 143 through 145. It was simply not grounded in time of filing person of ordinary skill in the art. It's evidence of what an MIT professor faced with an interesting engineering task unbounded would be able to come up with. And so it seems to me that given the factual findings, the extensive factual findings below, the fact that the panel considered the credibility of the experts and made a determination that as a factual matter, that Mr. Leinsing was correct, that this disclosure on all four corners, including the claim, including the word threaded, including the figures taken as a whole, only showed possession of externally threaded piston rods, it seems to me that that's the end of the inquiry. An interesting question, and obviously if the court were to affirm this decision on the 844, it essentially means that you don't need to decide the district court, because all of the claims in the district court are at issue here in the 844. So there would be an unpatentability finding here, and so you need not address the district court. You would ask, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, and that's because of cancellation.
Exactly right.
Not because the finding would actually have issue preclusive effect, because the burden of proof is different.
Exactly right, okay. But because of the cancellation, certainly at least because of the cancellation. And so that's one way in which you could dispatch of the fourth appeal as well. The interesting question that Your Honor posed about the effects on the of the district court affirmance on this appeal is less clear in my mind, at least. Certainly, the claims that the district court considered, which is a subset of the claims at issue here, or would be invalidated and null and void, the reasoning ought to apply and invalidate the remainder of the claims here, as well because of the, we're going to take three words out, but we're going to leave the scope the same notion.
There were just four claims in the district court.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. But it was four claims, but one was multiply dependent. So you'll find that Judge Chesler in the district court appeal talked about some intervening claims which weren't actually considered or asserted, but they, because of the chain of dependency, there were, I think, two other claims that were implicated. But yes, there were only four asserted claims in the district court case. So here, I believe that the rationale that the district court applied ought also to support the finding of no written description for the amended claim. But obviously that amended claim had no place in the district court decision. And so we'd be relying upon the patent office to jealously protect against attempts by Sanofi, for example, to secure claims of similar or the same coverage.
The argument would be that the substitute claim is not patently distinct from the ones that have been held invalid.
You would assume so, Your Honor, but I'll note that Sanofi is out there on a daily basis seeking more claims, and so we do have some concerns about that, but that's not for the appellate court to worry about today. We already handled the summary judgment, the Seinfeld-Jensen obviousness arguments. I think they are largely the same as what we had before. Obviously, the record is different, but I'm happy to field any questions that the court might have on those. In terms of the 486, I'm happy to field any questions you have.
What does the record say, and relatedly, though not identically, what did the board cite to in the record that says there's some reason a skilled artisan would use a half nut without the other half?
Oh, I see. Yes. Well, the panel below cited to Mr. Leinsing's opinions based upon his expertise at pages APPX 65 and 66. APPX 65 talks about how the board found that partial nuts, split nuts, half nuts were known. He credited Mr. Leinsing's testimony about how it would be an ease of manufacture and a reduction in cost in order to simply omit one of the half nuts. But that may be sort of losing the forest for the trees, in the sense that the panel also made a determination at APPX 69 to 70 that ClickGuard itself taught a single arc-shaped body in and of itself. So there's a specific factual finding at APPX 69 to 70 that even without talking about partial nuts, half nuts, whatever nuts, that ClickGuard shows an arc-shaped body per the subject claim. And so you don't even necessarily need to get there. And that's citing Mr. Leinsing's testimony of paragraph 156 of APPX 7320, I believe. So,
I'm sorry, where did you say the board found that ClickGuard showed a true half nut?
ClickGuard showed an arc-shaped body.
An arc-shaped body.
Right, not a half, it doesn't call it a half nut. But reasoning through the broadest reasonable interpretation of arc-shaped body, it goes through and the panel goes through and does the analysis and concludes that ClickGuard itself teaches.
Right. I'm sorry. When I say where, I mean, show me on what appendix page and where on the page.
69 to 70. And it's under item D. We find that figure 3 of ClickGuard shows nut member 32 having proximal and distal surfaces, et cetera. And it goes through and credits Mr. Leinsing's testimony at paragraph 156, which I just referenced. And then at the top of page 70, petitioner persuades us the proposed combination of Steinfeld-Jensen and ClickGuard would result in an arc-shaped body comprising, and it goes through the remainder of the claim language. That's a specific factual finding that ClickGuard in and of itself, by virtue of the nut depicted there, is an arc-shaped body.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm having trouble finding the words that say that directly. But you say it's implicit in the we credit Leinsing's testimony, 156, 1113?
No, at the top of page 70, petitioner persuades us that the proposed combination of Steinfeld-Jensen and ClickGuard would result in, that's the actual conclusion and the finding, and it's premised upon the finding that figure 3, nut number 32, has all of those particular requirements of an arc-shaped body. And that's citing and deferring or crediting the testimony in the declaration of Mr. Leinsing. So I don't believe that on the basis of these factual findings that there's a necessity of saying, yes, you have to find a single half nut in order to meet these limitations. If you wanted to do that or found that you needed to do that, I believe the factual findings supported by substantial evidence are here, as I've just walked through. That is Mr. Leinsing's testimony based upon his experience and based upon the understandings and approach that would be typical to one in the art. But I don't believe you need to get there in order to.
Did you make this alternative argument based on the shape and click burn in your briefs?
I believe we did, Your Honor. I apologize, Your Honor. One moment. I believe it's at page 25, Your Honor. I believe it's page 52. I don't want to sound like a quarterback just calling up numbers, Your Honor. So let me...
That's where you talk about clickbait.
Yes, it's page 52. 52 to 50. Well, it starts at page 52, Your Honor, and it continues on to page 59. But I believe the first section of that passage, 52 to 56, is all about the fact that the panel found that ClickGuard itself teaches an arc-shaped body in and of itself without any further necessity of crediting any testimony from Mr. Leinsing about reducing two half nuts to a single nut. And I'm happy to field some questions about Clicker A or Clicker B or any of the other modifications that came up in connection with the proposed amended claims. I see I've got 3 minutes on the clock.
And just be clear, the flexible arm is just the spike that's going around like a ratchet and then springing back to cause the sound.
Exactly right, and you depicted it, Your Honor, sort of in an up and down motion.
Yeah.
They can also go side to side. In a radial fashion as well. And obviously I'm happy to talk through any of those modifications and the support that we have. But I do believe that, here we've got almost 400 pages of decisions that address each and every one of Sanofi's mutating arguments over the course of the IPR. I'm happy to stand on those 400 pages. It was a lot of work for the panel. They did an amazing job in terms of trying to sift through all this, distill things down, and get it to a place where, the panel would, the Court of Appeals would be able to review it. And I think they did a remarkable job. And given all the changing and shifting that happened here in connection with these amended claims and so forth. So unless the panel has further questions, I'm happy to see a whopping minute of my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlston.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Banks, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a few points I'd like to raise. And to answer your question just about the record, if you look at Appendix 89 to 90, that's where the board discusses the party's arguments with respect to the clicker limitations. And it references the patent owner reply at pages 10 to 14. Not all of those pages are in the JA because this issue hadn't been raised in the briefs. But if you look in particular at Appendix 1078, that's one place in the record where you show our arguments as it relates to the clicker limitations. On the written description issue.
As it relates to these 2 points about the axial movement and the distal.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. On the written description issue, counsel pointed to pages 138 and 139, where the board recites Mr. Leinsing's testimony. I think the key there again is that Mr. Leinsing is anchoring his opinion in the fact that the application describes this arrangement in the embodiment shown in the figures. And so again, he's describing that and saying that there's an arrangement where they are concentrically arranged such that there's an externally threaded piston rod, but that's because it's the way it's shown in this picture. And again, there's nothing in the specification that would limit it to that disclosure. I mean, this is again a genus of two. They're well known in the art. There's only two ways to arrange it. You can easily visualize both arrangements. And in fact, artisans had envisioned them in the past with medical injection devices comprising internally threaded piston rods. Finally, on the ClickGuard reference and the idea that ClickGuard itself demonstrates a use of an arc-shaped body, I would direct the panel's attention to Appendix 68. That is where the board finds that petitioner proposes modifying what ClickGuard describes as nut member 32 into a half nut. So the idea that it found that it already was a half nut is just is not supported by the record. And I don't think the finding that counsel pointed you to or the purported finding that counsel pointed to you says as much.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you, Mr. Thanks. Banks.